So did the Arabs. The partition would mean war, they said. Despite the Arab threats, the UNSCOP resolved to present the partition plan to the General Assembly of the United Nations in New York in mid-September. Every last detail had been taken care of. Again, it was the eve of departure for Kitty and for Karen. At dawn, Bruce Sutherland would drive them to the Lydda airport, and in the evening they would fly out to Rome. The heavy trunks had already been shipped ahead by boat. The cottage was ready to be vacated. Kitty sat at her desk in her office with the final folders to be put away into the files. All that she had to do was to put them in the cabinet, close the drawer, and walk out of the door. Forever. She opened the first folder and picked up the top paper and looked at her notes. Mina, surname unknown, age 7. Mina was born in Auschwitz concentration camp. Neither of her parents is known. We presume she is Polish. She was smuggled into Palestine by Aliyah Bet around the first of the year. When she was brought to Gandafna, she was physically very weak and sick and showed many disturbances. Robert Dubois, age 16, French nationality. Robert was found at the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp by British troops. Robert was 13 years of age at the time and weighed 58 pounds. The boy had previously been an eyewitness to the death of his mother, father, and a brother. A sister, who later was a suicide, had been forced into prostitution with German soldiers. Robert shows signs of hostility and... Samuel Kasnowitz, age 12, Estonian nationality. No known family survived. Samuel was hidden in the basement of a Christian family until he was forced to flee into a forest, where he lived alone for 2 years. Roberto Puccelli, age 12, Italian nationality. No known family survived. Liberated at Auschwitz. We found him permanently crippled in his right arm as a result of beatings. Marcia Klashkin, age 13, Romanian nationality, no known family, found at Dachau. Hans Bellman, age 10, Dutch nationality, no known family, found at Auschwitz, hidden by Christians. The files went on and on. No survivors. This child has the dream so prevalent with those children at Auschwitz. She dreams she is packing a suitcase. This, we know, is a symbol of death, for suitcases were always packed the night before inmates were transferred to the Birkenau gas chambers. The dream of smelling smoke is symbolic of the smell of burning flesh from the crematoriums. Bedwetting, overt hostility, nightmares, belligerence. Kitty looked at a copy of the letter she had once written to Harriet Saltzman. My dear friend, you have asked my opinion of the common denominator and the reason we are able to get such quick recoveries and dynamic results from those children who are borderline psychopaths. Well, I think you know that answer far better than I. You gave it to me the first time I saw you in Jerusalem. The wonder drug is called Eretz Yisrael. The spirit is so strong here it seems unnatural. They desire only to live and fight for their country. I have never seen such energy or drive among adults, much less children. Kitty Fremont closed the files. She stood up and looked around the office for several moments, then quickly snapped off the light and closed the door behind her. She stopped outside the building for a moment. Halfway up the hill toward Fort Esther, she saw a campfire. The Gardner children, the 10 and 12 and 14-year-old soldiers, would be singing and dancing a hora. She shined her flashlight on the ground and crossed the green. New trenches had been dug. Larger bomb shelters were being installed by the children's houses. The statue of Daphne stood its vigil.
Shalom, Gevert Kitty,
a group of youngsters shrilled as they raced to the recreation hall. She opened her cottage door. The suitcases were all lined up near the door and marked with tags. The room was denuded of the personal little touches that she and Karen had put into it.
Karen, are you here, dear?
There was a note on the kitchen table. Dear Kitty, the gang wanted to have a farewell campfire. I won't stay out too late. Love, Karen. Kitty lit a cigarette and paced the room restlessly. She closed the draperies to shut off the view of the lights on the valley floor. She found herself holding the curtains which her children had made for her. 10 of them had already left Gandafna to go to the Palmach, that sad little army of the Jews. It was stifling inside. She walked to the porch. The air was scented with rose blooms. Kitty walked down the dirt path between the rows of cottages, all set inside little lawns and hedges and trees. She came to the end of the path and started to go back, but was attracted by the light in Dr. Lieberman's cottage. Poor old fellow, Kitty thought. Both his son and daughter had left the university and were in the Negev Brigade of the Palmach, so far away. She walked to the door and knocked. The housekeeper, as old and as quaint as Dr. Lieberman, led her to his study. The little hunchback was engrossed in translating some ancient Hebraic on a piece of pottery. A soft background of a Schumann symphony played on the radio. Dr. Lieberman looked up and saw Kitty and set his magnifying glass down.
Shalom, Kitty said.
He smiled. She had never greeted him before in Hebrew.
Shalom, Kitty, he said. It is such a nice word for good friends to use to say goodbye.
Shalom is a beautiful word, and it is also a nice way for good friends to say hello.
Kitty, my dear.
Yes, Dr. Lieberman. Shalom. I am staying at Gandafna. This is where I belong.
Book 4. Awake in Glory. Be merciful unto me, O God, be merciful unto me, for my soul trusteth in thee. Yea, in the shadow of thy wings will I make my refuge, until these calamities are overpast. He shall send from heaven and save me. He reproacheth him that would swallow me up. God shall send forth his mercy and his truth. My soul is among lions, and I lie even among them that are on fire, even the sons of men, whose teeth are spears and arrows, and their tongue a sharp sword. They have prepared a net for my steps. My soul is bowed down. They have digged a pit before me, into the midst whereof they are fallen themselves. Awake up, my glory. I will rouse the dawn. The 57th Psalm of David. Chapter 1. Autumn, 1947. United Nations, Flushing Meadow, New York. The 6,000-year-old case of the Jewish people was placed before the conscience of man. Chaim Weizmann of the World Zionists and elder statesman Barak Ben Kanan led a 12-man delegation to Flushing Meadow for the showdown. This delegation, seasoned by years of frustration and adversity, held no illusions. An informal headquarters was established in Dr. Weizmann's mid-Manhattan apartment. The delegates were assigned to the task of getting votes. Weizmann took as his personal job the alerting of Jews throughout the world to bring attention and pressure upon their governments. Barak Ben Kanan worked quietly behind the scenes. It was his job to keep abreast of the hourly shifts in strength. analyze and plug up weak spots, maneuver and reassign his men to meet any sudden changes, and spearhead the committee room debates. After initial parliamentary jockeying, the Palestine partition went on the agenda. The Arabs went into Lake Success sure of victory. They had obtained UN membership for the Muslim state of Afghanistan and the medieval feudal kingdom of Yemen, bringing the Arab-Muslim bloc to 11 votes in the General Assembly. These latter were nations who had sat out World War II in silence and declared war against Germany in the last moment to qualify for the United Nations membership. The Yishuv, which had contributed so richly to the Allied cause, had no vote. The Arabs used the 11 votes to dangle as bait before delegates from smaller nations. In exchange for a vote against partition, they offered their votes as a bribe to those who aspired to some of the lush jobs in the UN. The Arabs also took full advantage of the Cold War that existed between the two giants, the United States and the Soviet Union, deftly playing off one against the other. From the start, it was obvious that passage of partition would need the blessing of both of these nations. Russia and the United States had never before joined on an issue, and it appeared little likely that they would do it now. To win partition, a two-thirds majority was needed. The Yishuv had to get 22 votes merely to offset the 11 of the Arab-Muslim bloc. From that point on, they had to obtain 2 votes to each one the Arabs obtained. Mathematically, the Arabs needed only a half dozen additional votes to eliminate partition. With their oil as an additional bargaining factor, it would be an easy matter. The non-Arab world press generally favored partition. Moreover, Jan Smuts of South Africa and the great liberal Jan Masaryk of Czechoslovakia were out on the front of the battle lines. The Danes, the Norwegians, and a few others could be counted upon to the end. Sentiment for partition was strong, but sympathy would not be enough. Then the big four powers, the mighty ones, abandoned the Yishuv. France, who had been overtly friendly to illegal immigration, suddenly reverted to caution. Arabs in the French colonies of Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia were rumbling with unrest. A French vote for partition could well trigger an explosion among them. The Soviet Union had different reasons. For over 2 decades, Zionism had been outlawed. The Russians set out upon a program to erase Judaism by a slow, abrasive process. While on paper they granted religious freedom, it was non-existent in reality. There was no Jewish press, theater, school, or community life. Synagogues were limited. There was but one in all of Moscow. No member of a synagogue was allowed membership in the Communist Party. By these means, the Russians hoped to eliminate Judaism in the new generations. Zionism and the partition of Palestine could serve to remind the Russian Jews that they were Jews, and partition was therefore opposed. With the Soviet Union went the powerful Slav bloc. The position of the United States was the most disheartening setback the Yishuv suffered. The president, the press, and people were sympathetic, but international politics put the United States officially into an equivocal position. To support partition meant splitting the cornerstone of the Western world by breaking the Anglo-American solidarity. Great Britain still dominated the Middle East. American foreign policy was linked to Britain's. To vote for partition was publicly to rebuff Britain. More than this, the United States faced a greater threat. If partition was voted, the Arabs threatened war. If war came, the United Nations would be bound to enforce peace, and the Soviet Union or her satellites would put troops into the Middle East as part of an international force. This was America's greatest fear, and the reason she chose to hedge on partition. Of the 4 major powers, Great Britain struck the most deadly blows against partition. When the British turned the mandate question over to the United Nations, they thought that the United Nations could not reach a solution and that Britain would therefore be asked to remain in Palestine. Then UNSCOP went to Palestine, investigated, and reached a decision that censured British rule. Moreover, the world had learned that England's 100,000-man army had not been able to cope with the determined Jews of the Haganah, Palmach, Maccabees, and Aliyah Bet, a terrible blow to British prestige. Britain had to maintain her position of power in the Middle East, and to do so she had to save face with the Arabs by scuttling partition. Britain played on America's fear of Russian troops getting into the Middle East by announcing that she would withdraw her garrison by August of 1948. Further, she would not use her force in Palestine to enforce a United Nations decision. Thus checkmating the United States, Britain caused the Commonwealth countries to abstain from voting and applied pressure to those small European countries who were tied to her economically. The rest of the picture was equally black for the Yishuv. Belgium, Holland, and Luxembourg bowed before British pressure. Other small countries whom the Yishuv had counted upon began to balk. The position of the Asian countries was variable. They changed their minds and shifted their votes hourly. However, it appeared that the Asians would side with the Arabs as a gesture to the Western powers of their eternal hatred of colonial imperialism, and as evidence of their purchase of the Arab theme that the Jews were representatives of the West in a part of the world where they did not belong. Greece had an intense dislike for the Arabs, but 150,000 Greek nationals lived in Egypt. Egypt made painfully clear the fate of this minority if the Greeks voted for partition. Ethiopia had little love for Egypt, but was tied to her geographically and economically. Romulo of the Philippines stood against partition. The Colombians were overtly anti-Jewish. The Central and South American countries held one-third of the United Nations 57 votes. Most of these countries were completely removed from the issue and neutral. The Yishuv wanted Jerusalem as the capital of their state. They felt that without Jerusalem, a Jewish state would be a body without a heart. The South and Central American countries were predominantly Catholic. The Vatican wanted Jerusalem internationalized. If the Yishuv pressed for Jerusalem, there was a risk of losing this vital block of votes. But the Yishuv continued to labor, hoping for the miracle which was obviously needed. Throughout September and October, Dr. Weizmann and Barak Ben-Kanan were an inspiration to the delegation. They never despaired at the frequent reversals and were never stampeded into errors in strategy. The greatest weapon the Yishuv had was truth. It was the truth that the neutral UNSCOP had found in Palestine. The truth that Palestine was a tyranny-ridden police state. The truth, seen through the thin veil of Arab deception, of the Arab failure to advance culturally, economically, and socially from the Dark Ages. The truth apparent in the Jewish cities that had sprung from sand and the Jewish fields that had been made to grow from desolation. The truth of industry and ingenuity. The truth, implicit in the DP camps, of the humanity of the Jewish case. Granados of Guatemala, Lester Pearson of Canada, Evett of Australia, Masaryk of Czechoslovakia, Smuts of South Africa, Fabregat of Uruguay, and a lot of little men from little nations would not let the truth die at Flushing Meadow. Finally, in November of that autumn of 1947, the miracle of Lake Success began to unfold. First came a cautiously worded statement from the United States in favor of the principle of partition. Then came a move that rocked the world. After outlawing Zionism for over two decades, the Soviet Union made one of its startling reversals and announced itself as favoring partition. The news was released after a secret caucus of the Slav bloc. Vyshinsky orated in impassioned tones of the rivers of Jewish blood shed and the justice of a Jewish homeland. Behind this humanitarian mask, the Russians had made a shrewd political maneuver. First, they openly mistrusted the Arabs. They realized that the Arab anger was merely a verbal expedient. Russia could vote for partition today and buy the Arabs back tomorrow. Meanwhile, the Soviet strategy was to brand Great Britain a tyrant, at the same time making a move that could possibly lead to a Russian foothold in the Middle East. Russia knew that if she voted for partition, the United States had to follow suit or lose face around the world as a friend of justice. This in turn meant a break in Anglo-American solidarity. Finally, the Soviet Union stood to gain tremendous prestige value from its humanitarian proclamation. And so, inadvertently, the Yishuv suddenly found a strange bedfellow. As the two great powers made their carefully worded statements for partition, the halls of the United Nations were filled with rumors that cropped up every hour. The mammoth chess game went on. In the dramatic maneuverings, Granados and Pearson became key figures. After much labor, these two succeeded in the momentous achievement of closeting the United States and the Soviet Union in a meeting. They emerged from their conference with an electrifying joint statement of definite support of partition. The Arabs girded for a last-ditch fight to keep the partition resolution from reaching the floor of the General Assembly. Soon it became apparent that a test vote would take place. To get the resolution to the General Assembly, only a majority vote was needed. But this vote would indicate the strength of both sides. The vote came, and the move passed, and the resolution went to the General Assembly. But the roof caved in on the Yishuv. The count was 25 in favor, 13 against, and 17 abstentions, with 2 absent. If the same lineup held on the final vote for partition, the Yishuv would not get its needed 2/3 majority. France, Belgium, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, and New Zealand had abstained. Paraguay and the Philippines were absent. The Arabs saw that many sure partition votes had abandoned the Yishuv, and the Jews did not have the required number. Confident that they could bag an extra vote or two, the Arabs now switched tactics and pressed for the showdown on the assembly floor. Wednesday, November 27th, 1947. The final debates raged. The Yishuv delegation sat in its special section of the General Assembly, looking like men prepared for the executioner. The jolt of the test vote had shaken them to the core. As the arguments continued, their prospects turned darker by the hour. Greece, expected to abstain out of friendship to the United States, declared openly against partition, fearing what the Egyptians would do to their nationals. The Philippines, expected to follow the United States, reversed again. Haiti was suddenly without instructions. Liberia went back on the fence, and Siam crossed back to the Arabs. It was Black Wednesday for the Jews. As the day wore on, the friends of the Yishuv employed a desperation move to talk the clock out and stall the vote. The next day would be American Thanksgiving Day and a holiday. It offered 24 precious hours to muster the needed votes. The filibuster went on until an adjournment was called. The Yishuv delegation assembled quickly in a caucus room. Everyone spoke at once.
Quiet! Barak roared. We have 24 hours. Let's not panic.
Dr. Weitzman came into the room excitedly.
I have received a message from Paris that Leon Blum is personally interceding to get the French vote. Feeling for partition is running very high in Paris.
It was cheering news, for the former Jewish premier of France was still a powerful voice.
Can't we appeal to the United States to get Greece and the Philippines into line?
The delegate who worked with the Americans shook his head.
Truman has issued absolute orders that the United States is not to pressure any delegation. They won't budge from that position.
What a time to become honorable.
The phone rang. Weitzman lifted the receiver.
Good. Good, he said.
He held his hand over the mouthpiece.
Shmuel, from downtown. Good. Good. Shalom.
He replaced the phone.
The Ethiopians have agreed to abstain, he announced.
Ethiopia, under pressure from her neighbor Egypt, had been expected to vote against partition. The abstention decision showed great courage on the part of Haile Selassie. A newspaper man close to the Yishuv delegation knocked on the door and entered. I thought you fellows would like to know that there has been a revolution in Siam, and the Siamese delegate has been discredited. A yell of happiness went up at this Arab loss of another vote. Barak made a quick rundown of the roll call of nations. He knew it by heart, and calculated the vote shifts.
How does it look, Barak?
Well, if Haiti and Liberia go with us, and France comes in, and we don't lose any more ground, we may just squeeze through.
It was still too close for comfort. Grimly and tensely, they talked over the final assignments. They could not afford to lose a single vote at this stage. There was a knock on the door, and their champion, Granados of Guatemala, entered. There were tears in his eyes.
The president of Chile has just sent personal instructions for his delegation to abstain. The delegation has resigned in protest.
Impossible! Dr. Weitzman cried. The president is the honorary chairman of the Chilean Zionists.
The stark reality, the naked hopelessness of the situation crashed down on all of them. Who knew what pressure had been brought to bear on the president of Chile? Who knew where the screws would be turned in the next 24 hours? Friday, November 29th, 1947. The gavel rapped. The General Assembly of the United Nations was ordered into session. We shall have a roll call of nations on the partition resolution. A two-thirds majority is needed for passage. Delegates will answer in one of three ways: for, against, or abstain. A solemn quiet fell over the Great Hall. Afghanistan.
Afghanistan votes against.
The Yishuv had lost the first vote. Barak marked it on a pad.
Argentina. The government of Argentina wishes to abstain.
We have to cut the abstentions down, Barak whispered. They could kill us.
Australia.
Everyone leaned forward as Evatt got to his feet with the first vote of a British Commonwealth nation.
Australia votes in favor of partition, Evatt said.
A buzz of speculation went up. Weitzman leaned close to Barak's ear.
Do you think it might be a trend in the Commonwealth?
We'll just have to count them one at a time. We can't tell.
Belgium.
Belgium votes for partition.
Another buzz arose in the Great Hall. A few days earlier, Belgium had abstained on the test vote. At the last minute, Spock had defied British pressure.
Bolivia.
Bolivia votes for partition.
Brazil.
Brazil favors partition.
The South American countries were sticking. A vital vote was coming up with the next call. If the Soviet Union had a double cross up its sleeve, the world would know it now. For a satellite, White Russia was next.
Bielorussia.
White Russia votes for partition.
In unison, the Jews breathed a sigh of relief. The Slav bloc was going to come in. The signs were bright.
Canada.
Lester Pearson arose and spoke firmly.
Canada votes for partition.
The second of the Commonwealth countries had gone against Great Britain.
Chile.
Another delegate arose in place of the chief who had resigned in protest to his orders to abstain.
Chile has been ordered to abstain, he said slowly.
China. China, jockeying to become the dominant power in Asia, feared to go against the Muslims of India and Pakistan.
China abstains.
It was a setback for the Yishuv. Costa Rica. The Costa Rican delegate had been approached by the Arabs, who tried to bribe his vote by a promise to support him for an important United Nations post. He stood and looked at the Egyptian delegation.
Costa Rica votes in favor of partition.
The man who would not be bought sat down smiling. Cuba.
Cuba votes against partition.
This came as a complete and unexpected shock to the Yishuv.
Czechoslovakia.
Czechoslovakia votes for partition, Jan Masaryk said.
Denmark favors partition.
The Dominican Republic favors partition.
Egypt. Egypt votes against and will not be bound by this outrage.
The gavel rapped, and order came about slowly, following the Egyptians' angry outburst.
Ecuador.
Ecuador votes for.
Ethiopia.
Ethiopia
abstains.
It was a bombshell. The faces of all the Arab delegates turned to the Ethiopian with stunned expressions. The Syrian delegate shook his fist angrily.
France,
the first of the big powers, reluctant France, had its turn. Paradis came to his feet slowly. An abstention by France could prove disastrous for the Yishuv. Had Blum and the French people succeeded?
The Republic of France votes for partition,
Paradis said in a voice filled with satisfaction. An expectant murmur went up. It was the first excited awareness that the miracle might actually take place.
Guatemala.
Granados, the champion of partition, spoke.
For,
he said.
Greece. Greece votes against partition.
In the last moment, the Greeks had bowed to Egyptian blackmail.
Haiti.
Haiti was a key vote that had suddenly been left without instructions in the last 2 days.
The government of Haiti has just sent instructions for this delegation to vote in favor of partition.
Honduras.
Honduras wishes to abstain.
Iceland.
Iceland votes for partition.
The world's oldest republic had worked to make the world's newest republic.
India.
India votes against partition.
Iran.
Iran votes against.
Iraq.
Iraq votes against, and we will never recognize the Jews. There will be bloodshed over this day. We vote against.
Lebanon.
Lebanon votes against partition, Malik said.
How does the vote stand?
Weizmann asked Barak.
15-4, 8 against, and 7 abstentions.
It was not too encouraging. So far, the Jews were running one vote shy of their two-thirds, and the deadly abstentions were piling up.
What do you think, Barak? You'll know when they come to the next 3 South American countries. I think we shall have to start pulling away. We are near the halfway mark, and we show no decided strength,
Weizmann said.
Liberia.
Liberia votes for partition.
Luxembourg.
Another small country under duress in the British economic sphere.
Luxembourg votes for partition.
And again, the British had been directly rebuked. The Yishuv now stood one vote over two-thirds.
Mexico.
Mexico abstains.
The entire Yishuv delegation winced.
Netherlands.
The Netherlands votes for partition.
New Zealand.
New Zealand votes for.
Nicaragua.
For.
Norway.
For.
Pakistan votes against partition.
The pivot votes were coming up.
If we get over the next four, I think we are in, Barak said shakily.
Panama. The Republic of Panama favors partition. Paraguay. Paraguay has just received new instructions not to abstain. Instead, Paraguay votes for partition. Peru. Peru favors partition. Philippines. For a breathless second, the world stood still. Romulo had been called away from Flushing Meadow. The alternate stood up. The Philippines votes for partition. A roar went up. The members of the Jewish delegation looked to each other with dazed expressions.
Dear God, Barak said, I think we have made it.
Poland. Poland votes in favor of partition. The Jews were beginning to pull away. Poland had paid its small indemnity for the years of persecution. Siam was not represented. Saudi Arabia. The white-robed Arab screamed out against partition in a hate-filled voice. Sweden. Sweden is for partition. And now the Arabs had their backs to the wall as they went into the last ditch. Syria against! Turkey votes against partition. Barak scanned the balance of the roster quickly. The Arabs still had a breath of life. They now had 12 votes, with one more certain. If some last-minute change came through, it could upset everything. Ukraine.
Four.
Union of South Africa.
Four.
Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. Vyshinsky got to his feet.
The Union of Soviet Socialist Republics votes for partition.
The United Kingdom of Great Britain. The hall became silent. The British delegate got to his feet and looked around the room ashen-faced. At this awesome moment, he stood alone. The Commonwealth nations had deserted. France had deserted. The United States of America had deserted.
His Majesty's government wishes to abstain, the Englishman said in a shaken voice.
The United States of America. The United States of America votes for partition. It was all over. The reporters scrambled for their phones to flash the news around the world as the last vote was cast. Yemen gave the Arabs their 13th vote. Yugoslavia abstained in deference to a large Muslim minority. Professor Fabregat of Uruguay and the delegate of Venezuela gave the partition plan its 32nd and 33rd votes. In Tel Aviv, pandemonium broke loose. In the final analysis, the Jewish victory was crushing. The Arabs had 13 votes, and 11 of these were Arab or Muslim nations. The 12th was a vote coerced from the Greeks. The 13th vote, Cuba, represented the only nation on the face of the earth that the Arabs were able to convince by force of argument. Those men who had won this battle at Flushing Meadow and had seen the miracle unfold were realists. The Jews in Tel Aviv celebrated only for the moment. Ben-Gurion and the leaders of the Yeshuv knew that even a greater miracle would have to take place to win independence for the Jewish state, as the cry, "Perish Judea," arose like thunder on Arab lips. Chapter 2. Kwatli, President of Syria. We live or die with Palestine. Al-Kulta, newspaper, Cairo. 500,000 Iraqis prepare for this holy war. 150,000 Syrians will storm over the Palestine borders, and the mighty Egyptian army will throw the Jews into the sea if they dare to declare their state. Jamil Mardam, Syrian premier. Stop talking, my brother Muslims. Arise and wipe out the Zionist scourge. Ibn Saud, King of Saudi Arabia. There are 50 million Arabs. What does it matter if we lose 10 million people to kill all the Jews? The price is worth it. Saleh Harb Pasha, Muslim youth. Unsheath your swords against the Jews. Death to them all. Victory is ours. Sheikh Hassan al-Banna, Muslim Brotherhood. All Arabs shall arise and annihilate the Jews. We shall fill the sea with their corpses. Akram Yawitar, Mufti Spokesman. 50 million Arabs shall fight to the last drop of blood. Haj Amin el-Husseini, Mufti of Jerusalem. I declare a holy war, my Muslim brothers. Murder the Jews, murder them all. Azam Pasha, Secretary General of the Arab League. This will be a war of extermination and momentous massacre, which will be spoken of like the Mongolian massacres. Other Arab leaders and the Arab press and radio spoke out in equally appropriate words in answer to the United Nations partition of Palestine. On December 1, 1947, one day after the UN vote, Dr. Khalidi of the Arab Higher Committee in Palestine called a general strike in which inflamed mobs broke out in wild rioting. They crossed into the Jewish commercial center of Jerusalem and burned and looted while British troops stood by idly. In Aleppo and Aden and throughout the Arab world, other mobs, goaded by their leaders, tore into Jewish ghetto quarters with murder, rape, and plunder in their hearts. Instead of forming an international police force to fill the gap, the United Nations bogged down in the formation of committees and in endless talk. The body seemed to want to believe that partition was going to be enforced without dependence on a single gun. The Jews were more realistic. A Jewish state had been given an unalterable basis of legality. But if the Jews intended to declare the statehood after the British left, they would have to face the Arab hordes alone. Could a 500,000 ill-armed people hold back a flood of 50 million hate-crazed Arabs? They would not only have to face the Arabs inside Palestine, all around them on 100 fronts, but the regular national armies as well. Chaim Weizmann set out to organize the World Zionist groups to launch fundraising campaigns for the purchase of arms. Barak Ben-Kanan remained at Lake Success to head the Yishuv delegation and battle out the details of partition and look for arms support. The great question became, would the Jews declare their independence? The Arabs had no intention of waiting until May to find out. Although they held their regular armies back, they went about raising various armies of liberation, who were alleged volunteers, and they got mountains of arms into the Palestine Arabs. Haj Amin el-Husseini, the Nazi agent, was back in business. He set up headquarters in Damascus. Money for the Palestine volunteers was extorted from Arabs all over the Middle East. Kawukji, the brigand who had served the Mufti in the 1936-39 riots, was again commissioned generalissimo. Kawukji had been forced to flee Iraq when his part in the coup to deliver Iraq to the Germans was discovered. He spent the period of the war in Germany, acquired a wife there, and along with the Mufti had been pardoned from trial as a war criminal by the British. Kawukji's agents scoured the stink holes of Damascus, Beirut, and Baghdad, recruiting the dregs of humanity, thieves, murderers, highway robbers, dope runners, and white slavers, which he picturesquely dubbed the Forces of the Yarmouk, after a battle the Arabs had won centuries before. These Kawukji volunteers were trained by other volunteers, officers from the Syrian army. Almost immediately, Kawukji's forces began slipping over the Lebanese, Syrian, and Jordan borders into Palestine Arab villages. The main base was set up in Nablus, in a predominantly Arab area in Samaria, north of Jerusalem. In the meantime, the Jews remained arms-starved. The British continued to blockade the Palestine coast. They even refused to allow immigrants to come from the Cyprus detention camps, where Aliyah Bet agents were speeding military training. Yishuv agents searched the world desperately for arms. Then came the devastating announcement that the United States had declared a plague on both houses by an arms boycott of the Middle East. This boycott, reminiscent of the boycott of the Spanish people fighting Mussolini and Hitler, actually worked for the Arabs, who could obtain all the arms they wished. As the battle lines were drawn, the Yishuv Central confronted the blunt fact that it had only the Palmach of some 4,000 fighters, fully armed and trained. The Maccabees could raise only another 1,000 men and could be counted upon only for limited cooperation. Avadan did have a few things working in his favor. He had several thousand reserves in the Haganah, who had been combat trained by the British in World War II. He had settlement defense, which had been organized for 20 years, and he had a good intelligence system. On the other side, the Arabs had a staggering superiority of manpower and arms, daily augmented by the continual infiltration of Kawukchi's bloodthirsty irregulars. The Arabs had at least one excellent commander in Abdul Qadar, a cousin of the Mufti. As if the Jews did not have enough to contend with, there was the additional factor of the British. Whitehall was hopeful that the Yishuv would send out a mercy call, dropping the partition idea and asking the British to remain. But the Jews would not ask for help on these terms. In theory, as they withdrew, the British were to give the Taggart forts to the side with the greatest population in each area. But as they pulled back from sector after sector, the British commander often turned these key places over to the Arabs when they should have gone to the Jews. Former Nazi soldiers began appearing in the ranks of the forces of the Yarmouk and other liberation volunteers. For the first time in its existence, the Haganah took off its wraps as the Jews called for a general mobilization. It was not long until the first shots were heard. In the Hula Valley, Arab villagers, along with irregulars, fired on the communal settlements of Ain Zaytim, Birya, and Ami Ad, but the attacks were little more than sniping actions and were repulsed. Each day activity increased. There were constant ambushes on the roads, so that soon Jewish transport, the lifeline of the Yishuv, was in danger any time it came near or passed through an Arab village. In the cities, the action was even more violent. In Jerusalem, the air was filled with flying debris of bomb blasts. The Arabs fired from the sacred walls of the old city, and the city was divided into battle zones, with communications between sections made only on risk of death. In the streets between Tel Aviv and Jaffa, sniper posts and barricades appeared. In Haifa, the worst so far of the fighting took place. In retaliation for Maccabee raids, the Arabs rioted at the refinery, where both Jews and Arabs worked, and more than 50 Jews were killed. Abdul Qadar was able to organize the Arabs in a manner that Kawukchi and Safwat in the north could not do. Qadar, working around Jerusalem, formulated a master plan. Based on the realization that neither the Palestine Arabs nor the irregulars were organized and skilled enough to carry out sustained attacks. Qadar also realized that the Jews would hang on desperately to every settlement and make the Arabs bleed. He needed easy victories to encourage his people. Qadar settled upon two tactics. First, he would isolate the Jewish settlements and starve them out. Second, he would step up his hit-and-run attacks on transport. Qadar's strategy proved effective. The Arabs had freedom of movement while the Jews were forced to maintain tight positions. Day by day, more Jewish settlements fell under siege. Abdul Qadar centered his efforts on Jerusalem. The road from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem ran through the perilous Judean mountains and was dotted with Arab villages, which commanded several key heights. Qadar wanted to cut off and starve out the 100,000 Jews in New Jerusalem. It would be a vital blow to the Yishuv. To combat the effort, the Yishuv used makeshift armored cars to conduct large-scale convoys. These convoys were vulnerable, and the road to Jerusalem became littered with wrecked vehicles. Inside Jerusalem, shortages developed. People had to move about in armored buses, and children played inside sniper range. With Arab strength growing daily in new arms and irregulars, and no relief in sight for the Jews, Abdul Qadar was content to play a waiting game through the winter, then lop off the frozen and starved settlements one by one in the springtime. The Yishuv leaders appealed to the British to patrol the Jerusalem-Tel Aviv road on the grounds of the inhumanity of starving out a civilian population. The British refused. This quick Arab action under a good leader set the Yishuv down in the initial gambit. The Haganah gave orders to turn every kibbutz and moshav into a miniature Tobruk. The Jews had paid in blood for their land, and if the Arabs were going to take it, it would also have to be in blood. The Battle of the Roads opened the first phase of the war. The decision of whether or not to declare independence still hung in the balance. Ari Ben Kanan made a slow recovery from his wound. This posed a problem for Avidan, who wanted Ari to command one of the three Palmach brigades. These included Hanita Brigade, the spearhead, which covered the Galilee, the hillmen in Judea, and the desert rats in the south. The Palmach commanders from brigade level on down were young men in their 20s, often headstrong, who considered themselves an elite corps. The backbone of the Palmach consisted of boys and girls from the kibbutzim. They were communal in nature, even in military structure. Often they were politically opposed to the Yishuv Central, and as often as not, they resented Haganah authority. Ari Ben Kanan was mature for his age. He could appreciate the necessity of grasping overall strategy and carrying out orders instead of waging a private war. Submission to authority as part of a team made him desirable as a Palmach commander, but Ari was simply not yet strong enough to carry the burden. Each brigade covered a vast area in rugged terrain. The Palmach lived under the crudest of conditions. Ari's leg was still too weak. Avidan instead assigned Ari as Haganah commander to one of the vital places of Palestine, Ari's own Hula Valley. His command extended from the northern edge of the Sea of Galilee, included Sfat, and continued up the valley in a finger-like jut of land that pressed between the Lebanese and Syrian borders. Slightly south, a third Arab country, Transjordan, bordered it at the Yarmouk River. Ari's area was one of the chief crossing places for Kawukji's irregulars. If all-out war came and the regular Arab armies invaded Palestine, the Hula Valley was certain to be one of the first objectives. The Arabs would attempt a junction of converging forces there, and if they took the Hula, they would use it as a base from which to capture the entire Galilee and to cut the Jews in half by striking between Haifa and Tel Aviv. There were a dozen or more long-established kibbutzim and a few moshavim and villages in Ari's area, including his own Yad El, where the tough pioneer farmers could well handle the irregulars and Palestine Arabs. The settlements on the valley floor were close enough together to make it difficult for the Arabs to use their isolation and siege tactics. The hills on the Lebanese border presented another problem. Here, Fort Esther was the key. According to British agreement, Fort Esther was to be turned over to Ari because the Hula was predominantly Jewish. With Fort Esther in Haganah hands, Ari could maintain excellent control of the border. Ari's headquarters were in the centrally located kibbutz of Ein Or, the Fountain of Light, which his uncle Akiva had helped establish. He had a few hundred Palmach troops from the Spearhead Brigade. He had David, Zev Gilboa, and Yoav Yakoni as aides. The Haganah organization in each of his settlements was strong, 100% subscribed in personnel quota and well-trained. The lack of arms was what plagued him, as it plagued the Yishuv all over Palestine. Every day settlement commanders harassed him for guns. He had none. Avidan had none. There were two glaring weak spots in Ari's area, Gandafna and Sfat. Ari felt that he would be able to protect the children's village once Fort Esther was turned over to him. So long as the road to Gandafna through Abu Yishan stayed open, the village was not in danger. Sfat was a headache. In fact, no commander in Palestine had a larger headache. When the Jews made the decision to hold every settlement at any cost, there were a few exceptions considered untenable. Sfat was one of the exceptions. The city was an island in a sea of 40,000 Arabs in surrounding villages. Inside Sfat, the Jews were outnumbered 12-1. Most of Sfat's Jews were the Kabbalists, who knew nothing about fighting. In all, the Haganah in Sfat had but 200 able-bodied fighters to face more than 2,000 Arabs and irregulars. The Mufti had made Sfat one of his first goals. Several hundred heavily armed irregulars had infiltrated and waited only for British withdrawal. From the standpoint of interior strategy, the Jews were in even worse position. All three key points in the city would be in the hands of the Arabs. A police station right over the Jewish sector, the Acropolis atop the town, and the Taggart Fort on Mount Canaan would all be turned over to the Arabs. In arms, the Arabs had enough to carry on a war for months. The Jews had 40 rifles, 42 homemade Stens, one machine gun, and one mortar, plus a few hundred homemade grenades. They could arm less than 100 men. Sfat appeared so obviously indefensible that the British even pled with Ari to let them evacuate the Jews. Remez, the hotel owner and Haganah commander, paced back and forth before Ari's desk. Sutherland sat quietly in a corner and puffed a cigar.
"Well?" Ari asked at last.
Remez leaned on the desk.
"We want to stay in Sfat, Ari. We want to fight it out to the last man. We have decided."
"Good. I'm glad."
"Give us more arms."
Ari leapt to his feet angrily. 20 times a day he heard, "Give us more arms."
"Sutherland, you pray to Christ. You pray to Confucius, Remez, and I'll pray to Allah. Maybe rifles will rain down on us like manna from heaven."
"Do you trust Major Hawks?" Sutherland asked, speaking of the British commander in the area.
"Hawks has always been a friend," Ari answered.
"All right, then," Sutherland said. "Perhaps you'd better listen to him. He guarantees British protection if you evacuate Sfat. Otherwise, he guarantees there will be a massacre after he pulls his troops out."
Ari blew a long breath. "Did Hawks say when he is leaving?"
"No, he doesn't know yet."
"So long as Hawks remains in Sfat, we are relatively safe. The Arabs won't try too much with him around. Perhaps the situation will change for the better before he pulls out."
"Hawks may have his heart in the right place, but his own commanders are tying his hands," Sutherland said.
"The Arabs have already started sniping at us and are attacking our convoys," Remez said.
"So, are you now going to run at the first shot?"
"Ari," Remez looked at him levelly, "I was born in Sfat. I have lived there all my life. Even to this day, I can still hear the chanting from the Arab quarters that we heard in 1929. We didn't know what it meant until we saw those crazed mobs pouring into our sector. They were our friends, but they were insane. I can see those pitiful Kabbalists being dragged into the streets to have their heads cut off. I was only a boy then. We heard the Arabs chanting again in 1936. We knew what it meant that time. For 3 years we ran and cowed in the old Turkish fort every time a loud noise came from the Arab section. We want to stay this time. We aren't going to run again. Not even the old ones. This time they won't have it easy, believe me. But Ari, there is a limit to what can be asked of us."
Ari regretted having spoken sharply to Remez. Yes, the decision to remain in Sfat took tremendous courage.
"Go on back, Remez. Try to keep things calm. You can count on Major Hawks to keep it from getting out of control. In the meantime, I'll give you a priority on everything I get."
When they were gone, Ari sat down and gritted his teeth. What could he do? Perhaps he would be able to send 50 Palmach troops when the British left. It was little better than nothing. What could anyone do? There were 200 Sfats all over Palestine. 50 men here, 10 men there. If Kawukchi, Safwat, and Kadar knew how desperate the situation was, they would be making frontal assaults all over Palestine. There just wasn't enough ammunition to stop sustained and determined attacks. Ari feared that the first time the Arabs tried one and learned how meager the Jews' arms were, it would become a stampede. David Ben-Ami came in from an inspection tour of the northernmost settlements.
Shalom, Ari, David said. I met Remez and Sutherland on the road. Remez looks a little green around the gills.
He has plenty of reason. Well, did you find anything interesting?
The Arabs have started sniping at Kfar Giladi and Metula. Kfar Zold fears the Syrian villagers may try something. Everyone is dug in, all defenses built around the children's houses. They all want arms.
Arms? What else is new? Where is the sniping coming from?
Atta.
Good old Atta, Ari said. When the British leave, it's going to be my first objective. When I was a boy, they tried beating me up when I went to get the grain milled. They've been looking for a fight ever since. It is my guess that half of Kawukji's men are crossing over through Atta.
Or Abu Yasha, David said.
Ari looked up angrily. David knew it was a sore point. I have reliable friends in Abu Yasha, Ari said.
Then they must have told you the irregulars are infiltrating through there.
Ari did not answer.
Ari, many times you have told me that my weakness is allowing sentiment to cloud my judgment.